This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Our guest this episode is travel industry analyst and advisor Henry Hartevelt. We discuss new distribution capability, travel booking trends, the airport experience, airline computer systems, challenges for new airline entrants, and a lot more. In the news, we discuss a career pathway program with United Airlines, the return of ATC privatization, a new airline from the founder of JetBlue, and Rolls-Royce compressor problems. Also, Angel Flight Southwest and student pilot Nikki. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 509 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me first is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the Year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Max, how are you?
I am here. I'm so thrilled to be here. I missed you guys for a couple of weeks, and as I signed on with you a couple minutes ago, I referred to myself as Max Just-in-Time Trescott.
So it's been That's right.
It's been a busy couple of weeks, but I'm thrilled to be back.
Yeah, you've been doing a lot of flying, which is always great.
Totally.
Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and who blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hello, Max. Hello, Max. And I'm looking forward to speaking to one of my favorite guests that we've had repeatedly. And I know that he has his green jacket for being on multiple times, but I always enjoy the conversation with our guest.
Absolutely. And our guest is Henry Hartevelt, president of Atmosphere Research Group. Henry, of course, is a well-known analyst and advisor in the travel industry. He spent more than 15 years in marketing, planning, distribution, and strategy roles at companies like TWA, Continental Airlines, the Fairmont Hotel Management Company, and GetThere. He was head of Forrester Research's Global Travel Research Practice, and he launched Atmosphere Research in September 2011, and of course, serving the global travel industry. Atmosphere Research provides, well, trustworthy research and perspective to the global travel industry. Their research helps clients understand emerging trends and opportunities in areas such as brand strategy, distribution, product development, retailing, customer experience, loyalty marketing, as well as digital commerce and technologies. Clients include airlines, lodging firms, cruise lines, car rental agencies, travel agencies, GDSs, financial services firms, and technology companies. Henry is also regularly quoted in mainstream media. He actively shares his industry perspectives on Twitter at H. Hartevelt. Henry, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate being invited back and look forward to today's conversation.
Well, you know, Henry, by my count, this is the ninth time that you have been our guest since we started the show. But even more interesting is that breaks the tie you had with Richard Abulafia, who's been on Airplane Geeks eight times. So you just edged ahead.
Well, Richard is a terrific man, so perhaps you should have him back on and we can keep this thing going on. Richard's a fantastic analyst and a wonderful, wonderful person.
Yes, absolutely. We'll agree with you on that. Well, why don't we get started right away with some of the aviation news from the past week? Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
First up, the University of North Dakota has announced a career pathway program with United Airlines. Now, this new program solves, I guess, two problems, you could say. The University of North Dakota need for flight instructors and the United Airlines need for first officer candidates. In effect, this is kind of a pipeline for pilots, I guess you would say. Once a UND student is accepted into this program, they say there are no additional structured interviews required with United Airlines. As long as United's hiring pilots, then the students, if they maintain their eligibility, would be offered conditional employment with the airline. And this program is scheduled to start in the fall. Well, this is an interesting idea. We've talked a lot about getting pilots into the pipeline and so forth. And so a program like this, I think, has a lot of value. Max T, what did you think when you saw this?
I was thinking, boy, we've seen a lot of these lately. They're not necessarily exactly like this program, but the regional airlines in particular continue to hunt for pilots every possible way, and this obviously is going to help out the regional carriers that serve United. So it's kind of interesting. At first, when I first read it, it was like, oh, they're going straight to United Airlines. It's like, well, no. If you read the fine print, they can head to one of the United Express partners, which I believe would be SkyWest, Republic, and Envoy, I think would be the three biggies. And I think all three of them serve United. And what they say is that each partner has its own requirements pilots would have to meet to be considered for job openings. But still, it's a great deal. And I would imagine UND is the second largest aviation career-oriented school in the country. So I'd imagine folks that are particularly interested in United might be more inclined to go to UND now that this program's been announced.
And, of course, the students have to meet some requirements. They have to be full-time students with at least two semesters in UND's professional flight program. They have to have a commercial pilot certificate and instrument rating, maintain a 3.0 grade point average, and they have to receive a written recommendation from a Department of Aviation faculty member to be included in this program. Those don't seem onerous, I don't think at all. Henry, do you think this is a great way to get more pilots in the pipeline?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when you look at the reality of the challenge we have to recruit pilots, you want to make sure you're recruiting them from accredited programs. You want people who are motivated, smart, capable. I think these kinds of programs that we're seeing now are terrific. I know some airlines in the past had their own ab initio training, more maybe outside the U.S. We've seen JetBlue do some things like this. I believe American has something similar in place. More power to United and its partners, and to UND for doing this. It's a win all around.
And I noticed just in the last week or so that Republic Airlines, one of the regionals, announced that they are starting their own flight school in Indianapolis. I don't recall any of the details, but that's just an example of one of the many programs. The airlines are really, hurting for pilots, so they're doing everything they can think of.
Yeah, when we've talked about the pilot shortage or talked about the forecasted demand for pilots and aviation mechanics as well and some other associated jobs, the numbers in terms of demand sound huge and have all along, but I never really felt the need to sort of panic about this and wonder, how are they going to satisfy that demand? It just felt like somebody along the way would figure out ways to generate the numbers that we need. And I guess this is an example of that.
If I may, I just like to say that because the airline industry in particular had such a tumultuous period over the past 20 or 30 years, a lot of people who may have been interested in a career in the airline industry or in broader aviation careers may have pursued other paths, or they may have gone to the military. And certainly serving with our military is important and noble and needed. But whether it's in the U.S. or elsewhere, the pilot shortage is very real. It is global. It is very important. I'm hearing about it from airlines in particular in Europe, but also now increasingly from airlines in other parts of the world. And not to get ahead of ourselves, but I think one of the biggest challenges that new airlines will face will be recruiting and retaining pilots. And I think that's one of the challenges that David Neeleman, who has said he's planning to start an airline, may face as he moves forward in his efforts. After raising the money, finding the pilots may be his biggest business challenge.
Yeah, Henry, I think that's a really interesting observation. And we do see that Neeleman is, who of course is the founder of JetBlue Airways, but also Morris Air in the 80s that was later acquired by Southwest and WestJet and Azul, Brazilian Airlines. Mm-hmm. So he's raising $100 million to start another airline. It's been provisionally called, I guess, Moxie Airways. And they have a strategy that seems similar to JetBlue, but they're planning on using secondary airports instead of the major U.S. hubs.
Sure. And look, you know, David is a brilliant man. He's a great thinker, and smart people don't bet against him. What I would say is that his idea is not a new one. If you think about it, Southwest Airlines, Allegiant, and Frontier and Spirit have all taken steps, and Southwest built its business, of course, in flying out of secondary airports and secondary markets. In some case, you know, Allegiant finds some of the most obscure places in the country and, you know, provides them with scheduled service. So I think the challenge for David with his new airline will be protecting it from potential response by the big boys, because particularly the big three all have regional airline units that they could use to operate flights to compete with David. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how he works. I think his choice of aircraft, the C-Series, is a brilliant one. Again, he is a very, very smart man. And obviously, we know that business plans are one thing and reality is different. So I guess we should just wait and see how it all shakes out.
Hmm. To chime in on the pilot thing, pilot shortage, from the military aspect, I was having a conversation. We were down in D.C., and the offer that this person was getting to stay in the military and or go full time because he was reserve was astronomical for the Air Force to try to keep someone in the service and not go out to the airlines. So there's going to be a competition across the board. You know, we definitely have a shortage of individuals, and now everyone's realizing it, from the federal government to the civilian airlines. And it's going to be who's got the best offer, you know, especially for the military pilots. Do you stay in or do you get out? And the only advantage the civilian airlines have is they don't offer 6 months tours of duty in some of the worst places in the world. But if sometimes the money's worth it, and if you're young and single, it doesn't matter. But if you have a family, that's a big deal.
And to come back to Henry's point earlier when he said that there were some tumultuous times where people chose not to become airline pilots, you know, post-2001, we lost tens of thousands of people who were in the industry who were airline pilots who never came back. And some of them were on furlough for, I think, probably 7, 8, 9 years. And by the time they were called back, they said, you know, I found something else to do in the meantime, and I'm not sure I, you know, want to subject myself to that. But the other thing is, I think that for probably 20-plus years, we've been hearing pilot shortage. I think there have probably been a few individuals that have made a career for themselves out of crying wolf and saying pilot shortage. And I think finally it's real. For many years, I don't think it was real. But Henry, I'm wondering what you think about this. I know a gentleman recently who's never worked for the airlines before, has a lot of good general aviation flying time, mostly in piston aircraft. He's just been offered a job at one of the regional airlines, and he is 63 years old. What do you think of that?
Wow. I'm shocked. I mean, just because he doesn't seem to have jet time, and with mandatory age 65 retirement still on the books, I'm happy for him, but surprised that an airline would extend an offer given the amount of time it may take to get him trained and certified on the jet. But good for him. If this has been a dream, by the way, you know, he will fulfill it. And I would just add to what we've been talking about, everyone who is listening, if you've got kids, nephews, grandchildren, friends, whoever, who are interested in aviation, we all have a responsibility to help them understand what career options are and why aviation is a good and respectable and exciting industry to pursue careers in. And Obviously, there are a lot of different options. We're talking about pilots now, but airlines need everybody from pilots to data scientists to mechanics to people with hospitality backgrounds and retailing backgrounds and more. It's a very, very different industry. Thankfully, it is far more financially stable than it was. Airlines pay better than they do. Career advancement is possible. So it's a much more appealing industry in which to work. The challenge is it may not have the cool factor that saying you work for Facebook or Instagram or Goldman Sachs or Boston Consulting Group or something, you know, like that may carry. And certainly it may not pay as well as some of those companies.
Now, do you think there's any chance that airlines are betting on being able to increase the mandatory retirement age to 66 or 67?
I've spoken with airlines about this, and there is interest in it, but there hasn't seemed to be much going on, at least that they're willing to share with me in an official on the record capacity. I think that airlines, I think, would very much like to see the age raised. I don't know how the FAA feels about this and what studies they may have done. 65 today is very different than it was 20 years ago. 67 today is very different than it was 20 years ago. And there's not that much difference, I think, between, you know, 65 and 67. My hope is that the airline industry and the FAA would come to an agreement that might allow for an increase in the retirement age, and then give the pilots who want to stay on the option to do so. And those who want to, you know, retire at 65, maybe they can still do that too. I'm sure a lot of pilots' wives would love them, or spouses, because there obviously are female pilots too. You know, a lot of pilots' spouses probably would love for them to keep flying. One, for the income, and two, they're used to not having that spouse around. As one pilot's wife told me, she married her husband for better or worse, but not for lunch. And after he retired, it kind of grated on them.
Yeah, that does happen. But, you know, of all those career paths in aviation that are possible, one of them is air traffic control. And I don't know if we're going to need more air traffic controllers or not, but one aspect to that career path is maybe, you know, there's some uncertainty as to who you'd be working for. You know, we've talked about ATC privatization many, 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 many times in the past. Max Trescott, I think the last time it, well, went away with air quotes, I think one of your comments was, you know, it might be back, and it looks like it is. This is the White House has just released a plan. Now, this is a sweeping government reorganization. It includes a lot of different kinds of changes. Many of them, I don't know, to me kind of make a lot of sense. But included in the proposal are provisions to privatize air traffic control service. Now, this is in a document that's called Delivering Government Solutions in the 21st Century, Reform Plan and Reorganization Recommendations. And we'll have a link to that document in the show notes if you'd like to take a look at it. But there's a section that talks about the Department of Transportation. And it says here that this proposal would reorganize the Department of Transportation to better align the agency's core missions and programmatic responsibilities, reduce transportation program fragmentation across the government, and improve outcomes. The proposal would spin off federal responsibility for operating air traffic control services, as well as a number of other changes that aren't related strictly to aviation. Max T, this, you know, here we go again.
Oh, and I think it's going to be a here we go again and again and again and again. I think the forces that are pushing for privatization will never give up. And I think they've all got a lot of different reasons for why they're pushing for it. I think, you know, that general aviation in general is opposed to it simply because if you look at other places around the world where ATC has been privatized, general aviation usually took it in the shorts. They usually had, you know, fees that made it difficult. I would say the one example that might be counter to that would be Canada, where the fees are pretty reasonable. I think pilots there pay an annual fee of about $60. And you know, if we could guarantee something that would stay like that in perpetuity and never get worse, then you know, GA might be willing to accept that. But people are pretty suspicious of what could happen once the camel gets its nose under the tent. And the challenge is, if they truly spin this off as a separate corporation, at least past proposals have said that Congress would no longer have any oversight capability, or would have very, very narrow oversight. And so it would be pretty hard to, argue against any change which gets proposed, after this finally happens.
Now, a number of aviation organizations, of course, are opposed to this. And in fact, six of them issued a statement saying, "We are disappointed that the administration continues to reintroduce a failed proposal. Instead, it should put its weight behind FAA legislation pending in Congress that will advance the aviation industry, including general aviation, which contributes $219 billion to the U.S. economy and creates over 1 million jobs in the U.S. And that came from AOPA, GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, the EAA, HAI, Helicopter Association International, the National Air Transportation Association, and NBAA, the National Business Aviation Association. The six of them signed this letter. Henry, I think that many airlines are in favor, or seem to be in favor, of taking air traffic control out from under the federal government as it is constituted now.
Yeah, the airlines are generally in favor. I believe at one point Delta was not in favor of it, but they changed their position on this. And I believe that the airlines' view on it is that if ATC were privatized, from the standpoint of the airline industry, it might be easier and faster for improvements in air traffic navigation to be made. But let's take a look at who's in favor and who's not. It really is a bifurcated us versus them type of perspective here. The airlines seem to be in favor of it, and everyone else pretty much seems to be opposed to the concept. I think this always has the risk of, be careful what you wish for, it may come true. Certainly, privatized air traffic control seems to be working well in Canada. That's often cited as an example, and some other countries as well. I just think we have to allow, as we set this up, as much as people don't like government intervention or regulation where it shouldn't be, air travel, the airline industry, and general aviation both are too important to how our nation functions, to commerce, to personal entertainment and productivity, to many different areas. So we may have to allow for at least some amount of congressional oversight, or some ability for the FAA to have a say in some of this. I'll also add that I'm certainly no expert in how Washington works. I'm watching this very, very carefully and prepared for any number of potential outcomes.
Now, Henry, you follow quite closely the travel industry fairly broadly. Is that industry generally, outside of aviation, interested in this issue, or is it something that just doesn't, it's something that they don't relate to?
Air traffic control? No. The U.S. Travel Association is following this primarily from the standpoint of how might a privatized air traffic control system affect communities. But for the most part, the hotel industry, the cruise industry, the travel agency community is not following this in depth yet. Their trade group certainly may be observing what's going on, but this is not something that is viewed as having direct impact, at least now. If this ever becomes closer to reality, if this starts to become legislation or something more concrete, that's when you may start to see other parts of the industry, of the travel and tourism industry, start to pay more attention and potentially voice their opinions, whether it's pro or con.
I'm curious, going back to the pilot shortage that kind of popped into my mind as you were talking about communities, are smaller communities losing air service these days because of the pilot shortage, or perhaps for other reasons?
I wouldn't say it's because of the pilot shortage. I would say that there may be other reasons more economic than anything else. In fact, we saw United announce a couple of quarters ago that it wanted to expand its flying within the U.S. rather aggressively and do a lot of that with 50-seat jets. And so to me, that indicates that United was confident that it would not only be able to find the aircraft, but also the pilots to fly those airplanes and under the commercial terms that United needed. We're not at the point yet where I think airlines are saying, ooh, we're going to have to drop cities because we don't have enough pilots. The challenge is there will be a tipping point, and it will affect different airlines at different times and in different ways. But my concern is we are potentially close to reaching that tipping point if we are unable to attract and keep more people coming into the commercial airline core. I think what airlines would also like to see is some adjustments to pilot training requirements. I don't think people want to roll back completely to the standards that existed before the Colgan incident a few years ago. But I think they would like, some relaxation of some of the requirements to make it easier for people to come into the industry, get the experience they need, and become air transport pilots and start flying airplanes.
Yeah, I think that's probably the first thing that will happen. I saw that Secretary of Transportation Chao had made some comment that was non-committal, but suggested that they are perhaps looking at ways to roll back the total number of hours so that we can get pilots into the right seat of regional airliners with somewhat fewer hours than required now.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to our final story just quickly. This is from Reuters. Rolls-Royce preparing to cut thousands of jobs says engine problem has spread. And as the title suggests, there's two kind of issues here. I don't think they're really connected, but as we've talked about in the past, the Rolls-Royce Trent 1000 Package C engines powering the 787 Dreamliners, they've been experiencing an intermediate pressure compressor problem that's forced groundings for inspections. Now, Rolls-Royce says that some Package B engines are also affected, particularly high life engines. And so we have, it looks like, a worsening of the problem, more inspections coming. This is probably something that the airlines that are affected certainly didn't want to see.
I'll just add that this couldn't be coming at a worse time because you've got strong demand for air travel, which is great. 787s are new airplanes, so they're still relatively expensive on the books of the planes. And it's straddled into the summer travel season, which, of course, in the northern hemisphere, the travel season in summer is the peak travel time and the period during which airlines generate a lot of top-line revenue and bottom-line profit. And so it's been forcing the affected airlines to scramble for either replacement aircraft, whether it's their own or third party, or adjusting schedules, i.e. cutting back schedules or frequencies, whatever it may be, to compensate for the grounded aircraft. It's not pretty out there.
Right. Air New Zealand, I guess, has said that it was going to lease a couple of Boeing 777s to cover for the 787s that are impacted by this issue. There's also some reports that there are some difficulties obtaining enough replacement parts. It's a supply issue, and that could stretch this thing out over an even longer period of time. I think Rolls-Royce is single-sourced for their compressor blades. But in any event, there are some reports that there are some shortages there, which isn't helpful. Occasionally in some of the reports, you see some question whether or not other Rolls-Royce engine models might be afflicted by this same thing. Rolls-Royce says that, that's not going to happen. That's not an issue with other engine models, which of course would be even more compoundingly disastrous if it were the case.
Well, I was going to say, sourcing issues and parts chain issues. I think that's becoming synonymous with the word 787. I mean, we've been dealing with the 787 part supplies forever. It's sort of surprised that Rolls-Royce is falling into the Boeing category now on that airframe.
Well, they're not alone, though. I mean, look at the problems that Airbus is having with the 320 Neos. There are approximately 100 of those planes that are grounded, waiting for engines there. I mean, one thing I do not understand, by the way, is why any airframe manufacturer would pick a single provider of power plants for any of their aircraft. It makes the airframe manufacturer and the airlines that operate the aircraft vulnerable to all sorts of problems with design, implementation, supply chain, et cetera. And as far as Rolls-Royce and this problem with the 787, I'm old enough to remember, I was a kid, but I still remember it, with Lockheed and the L-1011 and the problems and how the RB-211 delays almost grounded the plane and certainly cost Lockheed orders from airlines that defected to the McDonnell Douglas DC-10.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe the greatest example of single sourcing of engines is the Boeing 737. All the Boeing 737 engines are from CFMI, whether they're, well, regardless of generation, except for the very, very, very earliest 737s. And that always seemed like a vulnerability to me. I mean, it hasn't been for all of these years, but that could change in a heartbeat.
Well, I mean, look at the Southwest incident. I mean, if we start tracking down those engines and those having failures, that could ground the whole fleet. And in like Southwest Air case, could ground the whole airline.
Yep.
You know, if for some reason. So I think Henry's right. You know, dual engines is always a good thing. And even the my beloved United States Air Force has gotten away from that because there was supposed to be two engines for the F-35. There's always been two engines for the F-15 and the F-16. But, you know, you sort of wonder, you know, when you go to one engine, are you hedging your bets, I guess?
Again, we're speaking with Henry Hardevelt. Henry, there are so many topics that we would love to talk with you about, but one of them is this concept called new distribution capability, or NDC. Maybe you can give us a little bit of background on just what that means and what the impact is and what's happening in that space.
Sure. So, for everyone listening, new distribution capability is a concept that was created by IATA, the International Air Transport Association. It is a series of XML-based schemas or standards to help develop on which software can be designed to help airlines retail their products better. If you think about it, the airline industry has gone from an industry that sold tickets based on fares and fare classes or cabin classes to one that is increasingly product-based. And anyone listening who has shopped for flights, especially if you've booked directly with an airline, may have noticed that airlines no longer have just first class, business class, premium economy, and standard economy. They may now have fares such as basic economy, main cabin flex, main cabin pirouette, business class with an ice cream sundae, whatever. I mean, it's all these different products that airlines are trying to create to help consumers find the value that they want and can afford with an experience that they like. And airlines now are generating a significant amount of their revenue and disproportionate amount of their profit from the optional products that they sell. This includes the nuisance things like checked bag fees and ticket change fees and seat assignment fees, to the things that you may like, such as priority boarding, priority security screening, a pass to the airport lounge, and more. The concept with new distribution capability, and it really should have been called new retailing capability, is to help the airlines
sell these products as effectively through a third-party system, a global distribution system, such as Amadeus, Sabre, or one of the Travelport platforms, through travel agencies, both online and offline, to business and leisure travelers alike, and allow an airline to offer everything from just a basic fare, with, if you will, just the seat and the seatbelt, to something that's fully bundled with absolutely everything that you may want, which from the standpoint of the airline would be limited only by its creativity and its partners. That could include an Uber, Lyft, an Uber ride to and from the airport. Again, priority screening, checked bags, extra legroom seat, special meal on the plane, whatever else you want to throw in, a hotel stay, cruise, whatever else. And they would bundle this all for you. And you know, this has now been in development for a few years. It's starting to be rolled out. It's very slow. The GDS companies have not been the most willing participants, but they're starting to get on board. But there are a couple of dozen airlines now that have new distribution capability standards published, and they're ready to start selling it through the GDSs and the travel agencies as they're able to do so.
Henry, when you say they have new standards published, what does that mean?
What it means is that it's no longer enough to just sell an airline ticket based on factors such as advance purchase and whether you're staying over a Saturday night and buying a round-trip ticket and refundability. There are 26 inventory buckets, because there are 26 letters in the alphabet, and they go from nose to tail, and they include the ones that we may know, such as F for first class, Y for economy, J for business class, and so on. And airlines obviously have multiple fares filed at within each of the different buckets that they sell, and they open and close those using their revenue management software. That hasn't changed. But what has changed is that the fares are really more products. The products may include or not include privileges and attributes. For example, you know, a fare may include one checked bag or two. It may include seat assignment or not. It may include a seat assignment in a certain portion of the cabin or not, and more. So what the airlines have really done with all of this unbundling is, besides trying to empower us to buy what we like and can afford, and by the way, make more money in the process, they've also turned themselves into retailers. And the old way of selling simply didn't work. We're not in a, if you will, TWA, Pan Am, Braniff, Eastern, you know, Western Airlines kind of world anymore. We're in a world of Spirit and Allegiant and Ryanair and EasyJet. And, you know, if you look at the way airlines sell, even airlines like Delta and Southwest and British Airways and Air France and Qantas, so big airlines, global airlines that have multiple cabins on their planes and operate global networks, they sell more like the ultra-low-cost guys because they looked at them and they said, wow, they're making a lot of money. I want to make a lot of money. I'm going to do the same thing.
And is the product offerings being developed, are they customer specific? In other words, if I'm booking a flight, but maybe it's more than just a flight. If I'm booking a trip, let's call it, from here to there, and David's also booking a trip from the same here to the same there, are we going to see the same offerings, same product offerings, or are we at the point where this kind of stuff can be tailored to the individual consumer?
Well, when you fold in factors like the components of artificial intelligence and then marry those capabilities with what the potential of NDC could offer, the truth is that what the airlines want to be able to do is extend personalized offers to you. So the four of us could all be shopping for the same flight on the same itinerary, same flight, same airline, because we're all going to fly the same airline, but it would recognize our frequent flyer status. It would recognize any corporate deals we may have if we're eligible for that. But it would also say, you know what? I know that David likes these things Max Flight likes these things, Max Trescott likes these things, and Henry likes these things. And there's going to be some overlap between us, and there are going to be some differences between us.
So Henry, are they going to figure out that I need extra leg room?
In theory, yes. And in theory, what they would do is also show you not only the flights that have seats with extra legroom and are available, but anything else that you may buy, and then sell that to you at one combined price. Because ultimately, as consumers, what we care about is the end price, not the components of what goes into it. We want the sausage. We don't care what really goes into the sausage. In fact, we want to be blind to some of that, but we want to know that we're getting good value. What the airlines cannot and should not ever think about doing is discriminatory pricing. So that means, let's just say the four of us all like the same things. We all buy the same things. That doesn't mean that they can charge any one of us anything different other than the variances that may exist based on revenue management. So that means they can't discriminate because one person is paying with an Amex card and the other is using a bank transfer. That means they can't discriminate based on zip code or anything else like that. That just won't fly. No pun intended.
Yeah. Is that because there are laws that prevent that, or because the backlash would be too great?
There are no laws that currently prevent it that I'm aware of now. But the PR backlash would be enormous. I mean, we've seen this happen in banking with mortgage and redlining and things like that. There, you know, the landscape of business is littered with failures, and some of them relate to terrible discriminatory practices. So you can't discriminate based on the willingness to pay more. But, you know, you can say, well, you know what, I only have one extra legroom seat available, so I'm going to give it to this person because I know he has a better chance of paying for it as opposed to that person who's going to wait to get it as a free upgrade.
Yeah, yeah. And will the net result of this be that airlines are going to squeeze more dollars from us, or we're going to enjoy better value for the products that we purchase?
The answer is yes to both. But I think that what the airlines would like to say is they feel that it's less about them squeezing money from us as opposed to them presenting offers that we feel are attractive, appealing, and meet our budget. So we may end up buying more things, but we would feel good because we're buying the things we like and at a price that meets our budget. And by the way, you know, we're still the consumer out there, and if something is too expensive, we'd be able either to opt out or search for packages or bundles, if you will, that in, you know, are less expensive but include the things that matter the most, but you know, still meet the budget. Hmm.
You know, Henry, there's another survey out from OAG on travel booking and payments that had some kind of interesting results, I thought. One is in terms of the interface or the interaction between the customer and the booking source, I guess. It says automated chat agents on websites were the most preferable category at 28%. Mobile assistants like Siri and OK Google were just behind that at 25%. Text messages, 20%. Wow, text messages, really. Automated voice systems, 18%. Boy, who loves those? And social media messaging apps, 9%. So how people go about the process of making their bookings, I think, is changing. It's on a trajectory that's somewhat different than we've seen in the past. Would you agree?
I do. And so what I would say is we actually have conducted our own research. We've seen enormous interest in these voice assistant technologies such as Alexa, Siri, and so on. We've seen airlines such as KLM and travel agencies such as Expedia deploy Alexa for different things to help people with trip planning, packing, other information. And the nature that how we plan and book our trips is going to continue to change based on the technologies that get introduced into the consumer marketplace. There are already tests being conducted for the use of augmented and virtual reality tools. I even told one person, one CIO, half in joking, that his airline would have to prepare for people using emojis to shop for flights. And he said that they were kidding about it, but somebody had brought up that several weeks before in a strategy session. So you know we change what we do based on the tools that are available to us, and tools like Facebook Messenger or texting or voice assistants introduce new levels of convenience and immediacy. And there's still a lot of people who like texting as well. I'm surprised that texting came out so low. And social media, people love that, not so much for planning a trip, but for assistance when something is going wrong. So yes, things are going to change. I think even in 5 years, we'll look back at 2018 and look at some things as being primitive. We're already seeing people prefer to use mobile apps over websites. That's going to continue to change as well.
I thought it was interesting that according to the OAG survey, 44% of travelers said they would be comfortable booking travel through Amazon.com. Maybe that's not surprising.
You know, I would say that what surprises me is the number isn't higher, because Amazon seems to just represent this generic term for a store that sells absolutely everything. I'm not surprised that so many people would want it. I'm just surprised it's not a higher number. And Amazon has tried selling travel a couple of times. It hasn't worked the way they want it to. And frankly, Amazon may be very happy using its Amazon Web Services division to host different travel companies' websites and other parts of their IT infrastructure. That may, they can make a lot more money, and they don't have to worry about the customer service responsibilities that go along with it.
Interesting. Well, Henry, I have to assume that you do quite a bit of air travel yourself. What are you finding these days in terms of the passenger experience? Are things improving? Are there areas where it's still a lacking experience for the average traveler? What are you seeing personally?
Well, my personal experience is that airlines are doing a better job of operating on time, and that takes a lot of effort. Certainly some of it is schedule padding. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as it's not blatantly misleading. Airlines are investing in the technology platforms that they use to help serve us. They're trying to empower their employees with more information about the customer, in particular flight attendants, by giving them not only digital tools, but applications on the tools that give the flight attendants information, everything from the customer's frequent flyer status to health information. For example, do they need wheelchair assistance? Are they visually or hearing impaired? Connecting flight information and more. So what's great is that the airlines want to do a better job in serving us. The challenge is, and I think it's very important we say this for the average traveler, not the top tier, super elite frequent flyer, or even an elite tier frequent flyer, but the average traveler is increasingly unhappy with travel. And they feel that they're not getting the value they seek. They feel all airlines are increasingly alike. And I think airlines really are going to face a challenge if they don't want people to buy based on price. They have to find ways to distinguish themselves. Airlines have created this price-based mentality among their travelers because they have failed to invest in differentiated customer experiences between airlines. But because they've put so much of the emphasis on their elite tier customers, I understand the economics behind it. I've worked on a lot of the analysis for that. But it's like we're going to give everything to the Peters and take everything away from the Pauls. And that's just not right. So, it's very interesting is when we do some research, we see that the customers who are unhappy with one of the big three are less likely to want to fly one of the other big three. And looking at airlines like JetBlue or Alaska, or onto your chairs, budget airlines. And the reason they like the budget airlines is they're saying increasingly there's not that much difference between a network airline and some of these budget airlines. The prices are much better, even with the fees. So why shouldn't I just save money? So I would say that the larger airlines really have to start investing, especially in their standard coach cabins, and making those passengers feel like human beings, not processed cubes of cheese.
Yeah. It also feels like people are just hungering for good stories out of the airlines. And
yes, but you know, the airline industry is the gift that has given for decades. You know, go back and look at on YouTube for recordings or wherever you can find them online of Johnny Carson or other, you know, comedians. They're always picking on the airlines. And go back and read Arthur Haley's Airport. You know, there are plenty of jabs at the airlines, and that was a book written more than 50 years ago. I mean, you know, High and Mighty, you know, all these novels, everyone loves to pick on the airlines. What I think is not fair is that we don't recognize when the airlines do things that are good, that they are trying to improve punctuality and reliability, that we've got one of the safest airline environments in any time in the industry's history, that you know, airlines are trying to do some things to better serve the customer. It's unfortunate, though, especially in the U.S., when we have four super large airlines, when something bad happens, you know, whether a computer or technology failure or something else, things just go off the rails, and a lot of people are inconvenienced. When we were fragmented, when the industry was fragmented, and one airline was affected, it wasn't as bad because back in the 1980s and even in the 1990s, you didn't have an airline that may have had more than 10 to 15% of capacity. So you had 85 to 90% of the industry unaffected if one airline had a problem. You know, you don't have that anymore. When one of the big four goes down, that's 20% or more of capacity that could be affected. And thousands, perhaps tens or hundreds of thousands, depending on the scope of the incident, that are affected in the process.
You know, from the traveler's perspective, the trip starts at an airport and ends at an airport, generally. Mm-hmm. Do you think consumers separate the experience at the airport in their minds from the experience with the airline? Are those viewed as two different experiences, or do you think consumers see that all as one, you know, the travel experience?
It certainly blurs. I think a lot will depend on the traveler, how experienced or inexperienced the traveler are, how frequent and or infrequent that traveler is, and the airline and airport combination. So if you are flying to, from, or through an airline's hub, where it's the primary leaseholder at the airport and the concourse has its signage all over the place and the seats are, you know, have the airline's logo and so on, a very controlled environment, you're going to associate that airline and airport as you would the laces and the shoe, the laces and the shoe. They just are one. If you are starting or ending your trip at a spoke airport, or if you are connecting at an airport where the airline has a small presence, or using a common use gate or something that's more generic, it may be a little more separated between the two. The truth is that the passengers do hold the airlines responsible for passenger security, not the airport and not the TSA. And of course, it is the TSA that runs airport security or oversees it in the United States. In some airports, in some countries, the home airline has influence over things like the passenger security screening experience. They can work with the security agency to smooth out things. That's not the same here in the U.S.
You know, the airline systems, the IT systems, can also have an effect on the experience. And we've seen some examples of that, PSA crew scheduling failure, other IT system issues. Maybe briefly, Henry, what are your thoughts on that? Are there some real problems underneath the surface in this area, or just a few isolated instances here and there?
Every day that an airline operates without an IT failure is, frankly, a reflection on very careful planning and a little bit of some miracles happening. You have to remember that there are some airlines that operate on core reservation systems and other systems whose, you know, were created back when Lyndon Johnson was president of the United States. And, you know, it's one thing to have airline memorabilia. It's another thing to have 50-plus-year-old technology powering a company. You know, I think that what we have learned, unfortunately, is sometimes airlines don't realize where their potential points of failure exist until those failures occur. And with every failure, I will say, there's a lot of information sharing in a completely, by the way, completely legal and professional manner, because no airline wants to see this mistake happen again. So there's learning when the failures happen, but too often these, you know, there's a lot more backwards looking than forward planning. Airlines underinvest in technology compared to other industries. Generally, in most industries, they will invest between 4% and 6% of gross revenue on their technology, including hardware, software, people, and so on. In the airline industry, it's roughly 3%. It's a little more than that right now because the economic environment is positive, but that's still below even the lowest part of that 4 to 6% range for all industry average. You know, and in some cases, you only have a single provider for a potential source. You don't have backups. Again, you know, airlines really need to go through this, and many do. But again, you sometimes don't realize you've got a problem until that problem occurs. And then what happens is you try to recover and you either create or discover other problems along the way. And that's what happened with the incident at PSA. They brought things back up. Something wasn't done right. They were too reliant on the system. It wasn't stable enough. It crashed again and so on. So my hope is that we will see fewer of these events happen. But going back to what I said a moment ago, as these airlines become so large, even when one system fails and affects one regional airline, it can affect thousands and thousands of people, and in some cases for multiple days. And it has real impact on the communities the airline serves, the people who are traveling, and the airline's top and bottom lines.
Yeah, and when that does happen, certainly the press and the social media are all over it, and you know, everyone has their opinion, their perception of, right, of the airline altered yet again.
Right. And it's, by the way, I should add, it's incredibly rough for the airline's employees who are struggling to do what they can to serve the traveler. They don't like the problems any more than we do, and they didn't create it. I think it's important to always bear that in mind. It's not like, you know, in the movie Airplane, where the guy was, you know, playing around and pulling out the electrical plug in the control tower for fun.
Yeah.
It's not like the gate agent or the pilot or the flight attendant pushed the reboot button on the, you know, airline's technology system. That just doesn't happen. And you're right. Also, in the world of social opinion, social media, everyone has an opinion. Everyone has a platform. Everyone is a reporter. And the smallest, most innocuous things all of a sudden could become big and trending.
Right. Well, Henry, fascinating conversation. Is there something on your mind looking forward, you know, through the end of 2018 that is something that we should all be thinking about or watching?
Yeah, I mean, not to be a Debbie Downer or anything, but I'm concerned about the global economic environment. I'm concerned about risks of recessions that may occur as a result of any number of factors, Brexit, trade wars, other actions like that, oil. You know, it's just something I'm starting to think about a little bit more. You know, I will say that, on the other hand, what's great to me is we're seeing a lot more creativity coming out of the airline industry. The growth of ultra long haul flights are showing that, you know, the brilliant minds that create these airplanes are now seeing these planes deployed on routes like Sydney to Houston, Doha to Auckland, you know, other, you know, San Francisco to Singapore, and more. And so it's very exciting to see more of the world connected nonstop. You know, I know Qantas has said they would love to have an airplane that could fly between Sydney and either London or New York nonstop. You know, I'm not sure if I'd want to be on a plane for 20, 24, 22 new hours. But I think it's wonderful that the potential may exist someday very soon for the travelers that need and want that for it to exist. So, you know, I think that the industry remains dynamic. It remains exciting. It is a far more financially stable business than it once was. It's a great one for people to have careers in. I don't think there's anything quite like it, you know. And for those of us who are passionate about it, you know, I think it still has that excitement and still a little bit of allure. It may not be quite as glamorous as it once was, but it's still fun.
That's great. Thank you, Henry. Again, fascinating conversation, as always. We could probably do this every week and not run, I mean, with you, and not run out of great topics to talk about. So we really appreciate you spending the time with us and our audience. What's the best way for people to, well, follow what's going on in your world?
Sure. Well, thank you. First, I enjoyed being a part of it. It's always nice to be asked. And always a pleasure to be able to share my thoughts. And I hope they were useful and hopefully entertaining. You can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at HHartevelt. That is HHARTEVELDT. I'm on LinkedIn if you would like to connect with me there. It's Henry Hartevelt. Those are really the two best places to connect with me.
Great. Thanks again. All right, moving on to what's up with the geeks. Max West, you've been away for a while. What have you been doing?
Oh, what I usually do, flying, and flying. So I think I may have mentioned when I was last on the show that I was headed up to Missoula, Montana, which was going to be my 50th state, and had a great time. Flew United up there, great flight up. I was a speaker at the AOPA regional fly-in. We had a lovely first day, and then we had a very rainy Saturday, which was the big day. So that probably depressed attendance a little bit, but had fun running into a couple podcast listeners, talking with them. My wife came up on Saturday, and we went up to Glacier National Park and spent a couple of days there. And not only was Montana my 50th state, but I got to see my first moose. So we actually saw a pair of them as we were driving along. So that was just spectacular. And then I was off to Wisconsin, where I picked up Cirrus with its new owner. And we were flying it back to Reno, where he was leaving it. And while I was there, I was tickled pink. I was just headed out to the TSA line, had just gotten up and looked out the window. And I said, whoa, that United airliner out there has a very interesting livery. And so I then went through the TSA line. And then I said to the guy who looked at my ID and was waving me toward the scanner, can I just go back there and take a picture of that airplane? So he said, sure. Now, granted, security at TSA at Reno at, you know, 6 o'clock on a Saturday, there was nobody else in line. So it was literally just me and the TSA agent, so he didn't care. And it turned out that that was a United A320 that had been painted back in 2011 in the Friendship livery, which was back from the 1970s. And so I shot a picture of that, posted it on Twitter. It was just kind of fun to see that livery. I always enjoyed that.
I've seen that airplane, and I just love it. It's beautiful.
You too.
Oh, yeah. Love it.
Yep. It just kind of engendered some, you know, fond memories, probably because flying in some ways, you know, felt a little more special in the 70s than currently. But anyway, it was spectacular. And then for good measure, my flight home from Reno was delayed 2.5 hours. Ta-dum-dum. Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, Brian couldn't join us this episode, but as we talked last time, he had a great experience on United flying to Dulles, and apparently he had a pretty good flight back home across the country as well, but we'll have to wait till next week to get his report on that. Meanwhile, we have a great interview that our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, conducted with Jim Daniel of Angel Flight South Central. And let's listen to that right now.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. And today I'm here with
Jim Daniel.
And you're with
Angel Flight South Central.
Okay. What's Angel Flight?
Angelflight is a nonprofit organization made up of private pilots like myself who transport medical patients, ambulatory, mostly cancer patients, but also anyone in need of medical assistance coming from more remote locations to medical centers such as MD Anderson in Houston.
All right. Explain to me how does that work? A doctor generates the request?
Yes, the request can be generated by a patient's doctor or a nurse or a caseworker in any of these cases. The patient cannot request it themselves.
And what's the structure it goes to?
So let's say the caseworker sends a request to Angel Flight's office in Dallas through their website. It's reviewed by the staff there for recommendation, and then once it's approved, it goes out to the Angel Flight website to pilots like myself. We receive an email every evening that lists available missions. Pilots can look through those for dates and times and select a mission. Then it goes back to the Dallas office where they coordinate those requests and then approve or disapprove the pilot's request to fly the mission.
So you have a central dispatcher or mission coordinator in Dallas who's putting requirements and pilots together.
Exactly. She's the mission coordinator. She's been with us for about 17 years. She has an assistant, and then we also have a marketing person that does grant writing and other marketing procedures.
What kind of airframes are we looking at?
Most of us, like myself, are flying single-engine piston four-seat aircraft, but as long as it's a certificated non-experimental aircraft, that's acceptable. We have a few pilots that we're very fortunate to have who have some heavier iron. We've got one guy in my city who has a Citation jet. I know there's a guy out of Midland who has a TBM, and sometimes when those missions fall apart, for one reason or another, we can call those guys at the last minute and say we need to go from Houston to El Paso.
Okay, and what does the pilot need as far as certification?
The pilot needs to have at least 250 hours PIC time, and they don't need to necessarily be instrument rated, but that would be that's obviously better. There are two courses, one through AOPA and one through us, that need to be completed that are both done online.
Any special insurance request, or is this just as far as the insurance company flying your friend?
Your regular insurance is just fine. In fact, Angel Flight will remind you through the Dallas office if your insurance is coming up and make sure that you get it, that you stay current.
And what's a typical mission?
A typical mission would be, say, someone coming from a small town in West Texas or maybe from El Paso that's trying to get to MD Anderson, and that would be a three-leg mission. Maybe that's not typical, but there are a number of them like that. So the first pilot would fly from El Paso to, say, Midland. A second pilot would pick up in Midland and fly from there to Austin or possibly to Llano, and then that final pilot would fly the third mission from there on to Houston.
Okay. Now, you've just talked about Texas. Does the Dallas office handle all of the Southwest or just Texas?
Great question. Angel Flight South Central covers all of Texas and Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, all the states that touch Texas. And it's actually part of a larger network of Angel Flights that cover the entire United States.
Okay, so if there was a special mission that needed to go from here to multiple state away for some reason.
I had something like that happen just a couple of weeks ago. A friend of mine who lives in Austin called me about someone that she knew in Denver who was trying to get their child to treatment in Chicago, way out of our area. But I was able to pick up the phone and call the people at Angel Flight West in Santa Monica, and they helped coordinate a flight through Angel Flight West to Angel Flight Central, which includes the Chicago area, and made that happen.
All right. Now, other than it makes you feel good and it's the right thing to do and helps your soul, why else would you want to do this?
Well, you just said the very number one reason to do it, but as a secondary reason for doing that, I've spoken to a few Rusty Pilot seminars before through AOPA, and one of the things that I tell those guys is once you knock the rust off, come join us, because if you don't fly a couple of times a month at least, you're probably not that safe. If you flew one Angel Flight mission a month with us, you're not going to be going to any more Rusty Pilot seminars if you're flying one other time for whatever reason that you would be doing. On taxes, it's a charitable donation, what you're doing. So I'm flying my own airplane. You don't have to own your own airplane. We have some pilots who just rent the airplanes from their airfields, but you can write off the expenses on that on your taxes as a charitable donation.
All right. This seems like a great idea and a good thing to do. If people want to know more, where would they go?
Our website would be the best place to start. It's angelflightsc.org. That's angelflightsc, which stands for southcentral.org.
And there you have it, listeners. Something fun and good for you to do with your airplane. This is Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
Max T, you must know some pilots that participate in, well, either Angel Flight or there's some other organizations that provide kind of similar services.
Yes, I've done some Angel Flight flights in the past. I'm not currently on their roster of folks to fly because there's, you know, some amount of recurrent activity to stay with them, and I'm so busy doing other things. But yes, I always thought that they were a fantastic service. I've flown with Angel Flight West, which is based here on the West Coast, and it's primarily for ambulatory type people. For example, I remember flying a gentleman from Happy Camp, California, which is a tiny, tiny town deep in a valley with literally 8,000-foot mountains going up to this town, which was virtually at sea level along the river. And he had a heart transplant at Stanford Hospital here in Palo Alto, California. And he had to come back to Stanford every 3 months for his checkup. So I went and flew him out of Happy Camp and brought him down for his checkup.
Yeah, I think Angel Flight is one of those organizations that's worthy to put on your list of charitable organizations. I know I've supported them in the past. David, you know, I first became aware of Angel Flight in your neck of the woods at Bluebell Field?
Wings Field.
Wings Field. That's in Bluebell, Pennsylvania? Is that how that works?
In Bluebell, Pennsylvania, where we have Angel Flight East, and they have a annual car show fly-in that I go to every year, and I've actually met my co-host there. The money for the fly-in that Saturday goes to Angel Flight.
Yeah, it's a great cause. All right, thanks, Launchpad, for that fantastic report. Now we have episode 12 of Listener Nikki's Progress in Flight Training, and we're nearing the end of the series, and this is, I think, the second-to-last report that we have from Nikki, and so let's give it a listen.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. Nikki here again. My last recording, I talked about my solo cross-country, and today I'd like to talk about some of the roadblocks I've had in my flight training. The first one you already know, if you remember back to my first recording, financially. It has been a struggle to always keep my at least one flight to two flights a week. It is very expensive to fly. One of the other roadblocks I ran into, most people probably would not have thought about, and that was actually my instructor. Believe it or not, after my solo cross country, which happened at the end of November, my flight instructor actually quit, and I was not even aware of this until 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks later, when my flight school sent me an email saying, you know, we just found out your flight instructor quit. What would you like to do? Of course, I asked for a new flight instructor, which took another week or two because everyone was on vacation. My new flight instructor, we talked over the phone for a little bit and set up a new discovery flight just so we can get to know each other the following year. We had about a week we could do that because I was going to go on vacation for 2 weeks after that. So it took about a month and a half to 2 months before I really got back into flight training through the year. The other major hurdle made me review the I'm Safe checklist and or, depending on which one you like to use, the PAVE checklist, and that would be the S or the E, every time I flew. And I had a major external factor in my life. My father was in the final stages of dementia. And every weekend or during the week, I was getting calls quite consistently that, you know, your father may not make it through the week, may not make it through the weekend. So I was taking time off work, driving 2.5 hours one way to basically spend 20 minutes with him before he passed out and went to sleep. And this was going on back and forth until, you know, if anyone knows what Alzheimer's or dementia is like, sooner or later he did pass away. But before every flight, I had to sit down and review. Should I fly this plane? Am I safe to fly this plane? Am I emotionally intact? And there were a number of times during my flying with my new flight instructor where I wasn't. In fact, I probably shouldn't even been driving a car, to be realistically. I was such an emotional wreck. My new flight instructor actually went out of his way at some times and said, you know, why don't we just go up and fly the plane in level flight and just let you relax and enjoy your flight. Sometimes we did this. Sometimes I would just cancel the flight altogether, saying, you know, I just, you know, last night I came in at 11 o'clock last night. I'm tired. I haven't slept. So on and so forth. Through all of this, I tried to make sure that I kept flying. I always tried to make sure I had money sitting aside for flying lessons. I tried to always make sure before every flight I reviewed that I'm safe checklist or PAVE, depending on which one you prefer to use. I personally tend to use both. And I always made sure my instructor knew what my emotional state, I guess, was. And he understood, which was very nice. So those are the three major factors I've had so far in my flying career. I'll probably run into more as I fly more and more. So this is Nikki saying good night and fly safe.
Sorry to hear about your father, Nikki. I know a lot about what you went through. And that's an interesting issue, to kind of be self-aware enough of your emotional state so that you can make a rational decision as to whether you should be flying or not.
And Nikki, thank you for admitting it and working through it. And your instructor is pretty cool if he's saying, you know, recognizes you were under duress and giving you the opportunity of just getting airborne and flying to relieve some of that stress. Good for your instructor also.
Yeah. Henry, have you ever thought about taking flying lessons?
Yes. So I actually knew how to fly an airplane before I knew how to drive a car.
Really?
Which is no small feat when you consider I grew up in New York City.
Yeah. Explain that one.
Well, you know, I was lucky. I had parents who understood how important flying was to me as a kid. And so I went and found a way to take flying lessons. I soloed when I turned 16. And got my private pilot's license. But, you know, it was not easy to keep up with this because when I was in college, my dad died, and that changed my family's world a great deal. So it was just something that literally I could not afford to keep up. And to this day, I miss flying. You know, obviously, there have been so many changes over the years in air traffic control and aircraft and systems and so on. It's a wonderful hobby. And I'm thinking about what Nikki was talking about. And I think instructors are, you know, good flight instructors are some of the best people in the world, because not only do they teach us to do something we love and teach us to do it well and to do it safely, but they're very good about reading that student of theirs and the mood. And you know, Nikki referenced these checklists that he uses. You know, really, are you safe to fly? Are you in the right mental space to do this? And I think these, you know, are wonderful additions to the profession.
Henry, Max is just right down the road.
Scott,
he's right up the road.
I know. Really? The challenge is I don't have a car. I live in San Francisco. I do not have a car.
Oh, now the story comes out. You learned to fly before you learned to drive, but you haven't learned to drive yet. Is that what you're telling us?
Oh, no, I know how to drive, but, you know.
I'm kidding. You're from New York.
I got rid of the car, and I use Lyft or the public transit.
Yeah. My wife grew up in New York City, and she didn't learn to drive till long after college because, hey, you don't need to drive when you live in New York.
Well, speaking of a long time ago, Henry, we just recently had an anniversary, right? Braniff had an anniversary, June 20th.
That's right. Braniff International, the first version of Braniff, celebrated its 90th anniversary, or what would have been its 90th anniversary, on June 20th, 2018. And as I mentioned, I'm from New York, but my mother is from Dallas. And so we flew Braniff back and forth to Dallas all the time. And it was my favorite airline as a kid, and was my, you know, other than TWA, where I worked, is my other, I guess, second favorite airline. You know, its colorful planes, the Pucci and Halston clad flight attendants, the wacky cabin. I mean, you look at some of this stuff and you realize, oh my gosh, the 60s were wonderful and the 70s were just insane.
Yeah.
You know, but Braniff also represents what happens when a business fails to keep its eye on the ball. And the risk of failure to a community, to the employees, to investors, to customers. It was the first big airline to shut down. And while there were subsequent iterations, none were really the same. But it was great. The Braniff Airways Foundation, which is based in Dallas, put together a program at the, I think it's, there's a flight museum over at Love Field. And they even arranged for Braniff's logo to be splashed up on the Omni Hotel in downtown Dallas, and I think Reunion Tower. And, you know, they did a great job celebrating Braniff and that special anniversary.
Yeah, that's very cool. Those were different times back in the 60s and 70s.
Uh-huh. I was also at the, I have to just add, I was at the TWA Hotel Museum Lounge in New York. Now, some of your listeners may know, and some may not, that the original TWA terminal at JFK Airport, designed by Eero Saarinen, is a landmark, and a private company is developing a hotel between that will it will be built between the original terminal and Terminal 5, used by JetBlue Airways. They have a private event space that is decorated to look in some ways like the original Saarinen Lounge, or Saarinen Terminal at JFK, located on the 86th floor of the World Trade Center, the new World Trade Center in downtown New York. If you have the ability to visit it, do. They have tons of original TWA posters and other memorabilia, including flight attendant uniforms. And among them are the infamous paper uniforms that the TWA flight attendants wore in 1968, when you could smoke on an airplane. Let's just put this together. Paper dresses, smoking on airplanes, people who smoke on airplanes and drank, like in Mad Men. It was a very bad idea. The concept lasted only a year and was never, ever happened again.
My goodness. Yeah, it would be interesting to learn the origins of that idea. But yeah, I can see why it didn't last. All right, just some other feedback and input we heard. Well, actually, in our Facebook page, Andy McLaughlin, he's the editor at Australian Aviation Magazine. He wrote in that he found our podcast through Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren. So he says, I'm slowly catching up on your back catalog during my long daily commutes. But Andrew says he'll be at Oshkosh this year. Love to drop by, say good day if anyone is around. So let's see, who do we know that's going to Oshkosh this year? Maxie, are you going to Oshkosh?
I am going to Oshkosh. It'll be my first time in 6 years. I went for 10 straight years prior to that, and this is the year I go back.
Cool. And Rob Mark is probably going.
Probably. I mean, it's in his backyard.
Yeah, most likely. David, anybody else we know offhand? I mean, we have some of our listeners that'll be there.
Yeah, and Rob will be there because he and Amy Labota are doing their radio show every day.
Okay, good. Maybe we should ask if you're an Airplane Geeks listener planning on going to Oshkosh this year in 2018. Just drop us a quick note. TheGeeks@AirplaneGeeks.com. Let us know. Maybe we'll kind of see if we can put together a list and make it as easy as possible for people to connect. We got an email from Grant. He says, hi there, bit of a long shot here. He writes, I was wondering if you knew of any aviation museums that have an exhibit of an airport security lane or other general airport exhibits, as well as aircrafts themselves. He says, we are currently looking at a project to supply East Fortune Museum with an active airport security lane exhibit to show off to the public, and trying to have a look and see if this has been done before. If you have any knowledge of this, it'd be great to hear back. So I don't have any. Do any of you guys run across a museum that has exhibits of that sort?
I'm kind of stunned. So he wants to find a mock-up of TSA, basically?
I guess so.
Wow. I mean, that's nothing I ever even considered, you know, for a museum.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like that in a museum. What I've seen for airports would be examples of the more pleasant parts of it, either, you know, models of the terminals from the architects' firms, or some of the furnishings if they're really unique, you know, or something like that. But security screening, no. If it's really, really well-designed equipment, they could approach a modern art museum, such as Museum of Modern Art in New York, or maybe the one here in San Francisco or elsewhere. The Museum of Modern Art in New York actually has a Solari board, those departure boards that with the little tabs that flip around and make that clickety clack sign. I do too. They have one of those at the TWA Hotel Lounge in New York. But anyway, you know, you don't really see much in terms of industrial things like the security. And to be honest, I'm not sure how the security agencies would feel about these being, frankly, in a public area for fear of, you know, just being tampered with or people learning things that the security agencies don't want the public to know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think that most people, I don't really think of the screening process as a pleasant one. And so I just can't imagine that, you know, there's going to be a whole lot of people, you know, but that's just my, you know, gut reaction on that. I mean, Henry makes a good point, which is there are lots of wonderful exhibits. And since he and I both fly out of San Francisco, I should mention all this month in the United concourse, all the way out to, you know, gate 80, whatever the heck. They have an exhibit of radios that date back to the early days of radio. So that to me, that was one of the few times where I got off the moving walkway and said, hey, I'm going to walk through and look at every one of these old AM radios. That was great fun.
Okay, I'm going to be the cynic here. It's not a bad idea. If someone's afraid of flying or afraid of going through security or whatever, to be able to have an exhibit that maybe isn't fully functional, but a metal detector and where you put your and a conveyor belt with an X-ray machine with reduced benefits, or even better yet, a 3D imager. Somebody who would have a fear of all of that technology might be able to go to a museum and get comfortable with it. So I kind of disagree with you both. I think it wouldn't be a bad thing for the TSA to promote this kind of stuff and say, look, this is what it is, and this is why we do it, and this is what you would expect as you got on the line at Philadelphia International or San Francisco or Connecticut.
So two things, if I may. One, I think your point is a very good one, but you know, the TSA isn't saying they want to do this. It's some private company. And I think that if the TSA were to come in as a partner, it might change things. But a museum, I'm not sure if the museum is the right environment in which to put something like this. And that brings me to the second point. Air Hollywood down in Burbank, down from me here in California, they're located outside of Burbank, California, is a film studio and focused, as the name Air Hollywood might imply, on airline and aviation. And not only is it the home of the wonderful Pan Am experience for those who want to relive what it was like flying in a Pan Am 747, but for their the various sets they have include an airport terminal, including a security setup. And periodically, one thing they do for families with children on the autism scale is to bring the kids through to help them understand what it's like taking a trip. And this simulates, the security screening there simulates what people would go through at an airport for passenger security screening. They sometimes do fear of flying seminars there as well to help people understand what the airport environment is like, the screening process, boarding a plane, and so on. And they have airplane cabin mock-ups that they use, which have been used in a variety of movies and TV commercials and television programs. Maybe the people who want to donate this should contact Air Hollywood, and perhaps they can work out something, because you know, that would be really, really, I think, an interesting potential partnership. The problem is Air Hollywood is only one location. It's in Burbank. But, you know, better that than nothing.
And yeah, I think you've changed my opinion on this, Henry. So thanks, and David as well, too. I think I came from the bias of, man, I go through these things a couple of times a month, and I'm tired of them. and yet that's not the experience of every. I mean, there are lots of people who have never seen one before. So, yeah, sorry if my bias colored that.
We have actually another museum-related email. We received an email from Marion, who wrote they're a mechanical engineer and aviation passionate. Says, I'm trying to open myself a small aerospace museum or open space for any kind of aircraft here in my country, in Romania. The project is entirely nonprofit and will be based exclusively on donations. It is more like an educational project and background to inspire and encourage young people, like students and school children, to start a career in this domain. For the beginning, can you consider helping me with a free charity donation of any type of aircraft, plane, or helicopter, even a glider, in any condition? Small, big, civil or military, new, old, broken, rusty, salvaged, junk, or even an airframe, an empty shell. Even a parachute or even something related to aviation would be good. So we have some contact information, and if you can help out in any way, just write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll pass that along, put you and them in touch. And then one final note, we heard from Mick. Mick always has something interesting to say or show, and he sent along a link to a video that's on YouTube, the Thomas Sopwith documentary, 1984. And this is a really, really interesting, at least I thought, historic video. There's lots of old video of, you know, airplanes from the, you know, the early days. Sopwith died in 1989. He lived to be 101 years old. And so we'll have a link in the show notes to this video. I really recommend it. It's, I don't know. I found it fascinating. David, maybe you'd already seen this.
I hadn't, but I've watched some of it. I haven't finished it yet, but yeah, Sopwith is, you know, there's more to Sopwith than just camels. So it's definitely worth watching and seeing early military and early flight. So definitely worth a watch. And I will finish it eventually.
All right. Well, that brings this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast to a close. We want to thank all of you for listening. And we want to thank our guest, Henry Hardeveld, president of Atmosphere Research Group. Henry.
Yay.
Yeah, Henry, it's always always wonderful to have you on the show and benefit from your experience and knowledge.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for including me. It was fun to be a part of today's broadcast.
All right. Well, you can visit airplanegeeks.com to find show notes for this episode. You can subscribe to the podcast there, learn more about all of us. And you can go straight to the show notes for this episode. They'll be at airplanegeeks.com/509. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. Max Trescott, we'll start with you.
Oh, let me mention a couple of things that I have never mentioned here on the show. So you can find me on Instagram, and I've been posting a lot of pictures lately of airplanes. Just go look for Aviation News Talk, all one word, on Instagram. And for Android users out there, I now have an app for the Aviation News Talk podcast in the Google Play Store. So just go out to your Google Play Store and search on Aviation News Talk, and you can download the dedicated app for a podcast there. And anybody else, if you want to send me an email, just go to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact at the top of the page.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
Well, you too can find me on Instagram if you know how to write out what just flew by. And you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. And I don't have an app, but you could also find me on Friday mornings on that show with Max Flight called the UAV Digest.
Henry Hartevelt, where do folks find you again?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at H Hartevelt, on LinkedIn, if you type in my name. I have an Instagram account, but I keep forgetting I have an Instagram account. If you'd like, if you have business questions, you can email me. My email address is henry@atmosphereresearch.com.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Also in LinkedIn, look for me there. As David mentioned, at the UAVDigest.com. And with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. And, of course, also in the Airplane Geeks listener team on Slack. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at BrunoMassone.com. And please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.